I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hier ist die Kompaktkurbel unter den Podcasts. David Corsten und Tim Farin reden über 101 Dinge, die ein Rennradfahrer wissen muss, und liefern dir Gesprächsstoff für deine nächste Runde.
Tim Farin, ich grüße dich, ne? Wie ist die Lage?
Klasse. Ja? Total gut.
Ging nie besser. Habe ich anderes gehört.
Schlechter.
Jetzt hat es dich also auch erwischt, ne?
Jetzt ist es soweit. Endlich ist es soweit.
Ja, Mist mit deinem Coroner, vor allem, weil du ja eigentlich was vorhattest, ne? Sonntag.
Ich wollte eigentlich Bonn-Olpen-Bonn fahren am Sonntag. Das ist jetzt ja erneut ein Höhepunkt, der hier mir genommen wird durch das Schicksal. Ich bin also seit gestern isoliert. Ich sitze im Garten bei uns hinterm Haus. Vielleicht ist es ein bisschen windig. Ich hoffe, das geht aber. Und ich sitze hier und verbringe Zeit mit mir selbst und mit dir jetzt dankenswerterweise auch. Und wollte eigentlich am Sonntag 230 Kilometer nach Belgien und zurückfahren. Das ist aber leider auch mal wieder nichts geworden. Sehr schade.
Sehr schade, sehr schade. Aber naja, so können wir immerhin jetzt hier aufzeichnen. Ich hab die Zeit frei gemacht, um dich auch hier ein bisschen aufzufangen. Auch aus der Distanz heraus, ne? Weil es ist ja, geht ja nicht nur unseren HörerInnen so hier in der gesamten Dachregion. Also auch herzlich willkommen an die Endgeräte, wo auch immer ihr uns hört. Also ist ja ein Stabilitätsfaktor in vielen Leben, habe ich gehört, aber auch bei uns. Gibt eben allen Beteiligten dann halt im doch unsteten, unsicher, immer unsicher werdenderen, unsicher werdenden, unsicherer werdenden, so muss es korrekt heißen, Leben.
Wäre richtig gewesen. Leben innen.
Leben innen. So, wir wollen heute aber gar nicht so viel über uns sprechen. Doch eine Sache müssen wir unbedingt noch erwähnen, finde ich. Du hast da nämlich eben noch, hier in der Vorbereitung, hast du noch einen Tweet abgesetzt, wer dir noch nicht
nachgerade rausgehauen.
Da heißt es, also @Tim_Farin, wer dir noch nicht bei Twitter folgt, sollte das, boah, du hast 10.000 Tweets schon, mehr als 10.000 Tweets schon, das ist ja Wahnsinn.
Ja, ich bin aber schon alt.
Und einer der besten kam heute, und da heißt es, wer jetzt bei The Zone kündigt, ne, also The Zone, dieser Anbieter von Streaming-Dienstleistungen, der Hintergrund ist, er erhöht seine Preise für Bestandskunden, und zwar saftig.
Massiv.
Saftig. Verdoppelt nachgerade. Da fährt ein Krankenwagen vorbei.
Ja, kann ich nichts daran ändern.
Hast du schon abgeholt? Oder hast du nicht bestellt?
Ja, ja, ist ja
gut. Genau. Also, The Zone, Preise verdoppelt. Wer jetzt bei The Zone kündigt.
Hoffentlich ist nichts Schlimmes passiert.
Ist das dann immer, es wird wohl schlimm genug für einen Krankenwagen sein.
Naja. Ja, muss man leider objektiv dann feststellen.
Das vermutlich aber doch was Schlimmes passiert ist, weil sonst müsste er ja nicht rauskommen. Ja. Wer jetzt bei The Zone kündigt, kann bei uns dank Join Steady gut einsteigen, netto immer noch sparen und viel über die Tour de France und den Radsport lernen. Also ein opportunistischer Tweet, aber es stimmt ja. Alle Fakten stimmen.
Ja, also rein
und dafür
da.
Dafür gibt es ein Like,
man
und
kann
ich
sparen.
Retweete das live. Das haben wir auch noch nicht gehabt, hier auf verschiedenen Kanälen parallel unterwegs. Das ist ja einfach heute praktisch Voraussetzung, ne? Dass man gleichzeitig hier Podcasts aufzeichnet, bei Twitter noch interagiert und am besten eigentlich dabei noch als TikTok-Creator hier auch noch ein, also um es dann später auszuspielen und noch eine Mehrfachverwertung dann hinzubekommen, da
ich
eben auch noch
in der
was
Zeit
macht,
einfach
ne?
mal ein Ich mache jetzt in der Zeit mal ein Bildschirmfoto mit meiner Computerkamera, wie ich das hier so darstelle. So, schicke ich dir über WhatsApp.
Super. Und das laden wir dann bei Instagram hoch und parallel schreibst du noch einen Text für die Zeit oder so, ne?
Habe ich schon gemacht.
Hast du schon.
So, jetzt komm. Okay. Also.
Naja, ne, man kennt das ja mal, also crossmedial.
Nee, komm, lass mich.
Ja, doch, doch, doch. Finde ich schon. Aber das ist gar nicht Thema. Also doch, Aufruf nochmal kurz. Also Join Steady kann man uns unterstützen. Also bei Steady, ne, ab 2,50 Euro im Monat. Wir brauchen euch. Wir zählen auf euch. Und die Kampagne läuft ja weiterhin 50 für 50.000. Da sind wir natürlich weit drüber schon. 50.000 Downloads. Aber 50 für 50.000, das heißt 50 neue aktive Supporter bei Steady, ist unser erklärtes Ziel unter dem Kampagnenclaim Schluss mit Lutschen. Und das ist durchaus streng gemeint.
Absolut.
So, Tourauftakt heute. Deine Begeisterung hält sich in Grenzen, weil du...
Nö. Ne? Ich freue mich, dass es Content gibt, dem man folgen kann. Und ich freue mich auch, da nachher einzuschalten. Ich selber bin ja jetzt, weiß nicht, ob es schon durchgedrungen ist, bin ja Corona-krank. Ist auch ein Thema jetzt in der Vorbereitung gewesen. Also man hat ja so ein bisschen Kritik wahrgenommen daran, dass der Weltverband die Regeln zur Kontrolle der Covid-19-Verbreitung im Feld etwas vielleicht abgemildert hat. Es ist also jetzt Antigentests und weniger PCR-Testpflicht und so weiter. Also in Summe ist alles etwas weicher als in den im Vorjahr. Ja, das ist aber wahrscheinlich jetzt, ist halt einfach so. Und mal gespannt, wie viele Fahrer da jetzt dann doch noch auffallen. Es gab in den vergangenen Tagen vor Tourstart, gab es schon ein paar wichtige Ausfälle. Aber klar, ich meine, wir wissen es ja, das nimmt, glaube ich, echt keiner auf die leichte Schulter, wenn da jetzt ein Virusbefall ist, dann werden auch die Teams selbst unter dem Druck, den die haben, nicht da wissentlich da ihre Fahrer mit einem
positiv dann irgendwie da rumfahren.
Das ist einfach zu gefährlich. Also das glaube ich nach allem, was man jetzt hört, haben die gelernt und verstanden, dass das nicht, dass sie das nicht machen. Also da würde ich jetzt mal sagen, in den allermeisten Fällen gehe ich davon aus, dass die Vernunft entsprechend groß ist.
Wer ist denn schon alles ausgefallen?
Ja, ich sage jetzt mal vor allem einen, Matteo Trentin. Das ist einer der wichtigsten Helfer von Tadej Pogacar, weil der vor allem für die erste Woche sehr wichtig wäre. Hinterher auch, aber in der ersten Woche essentiell. Der ist nämlich unheimlich stark in diesen, auf diesen Etappen, die da den Bergfahrern das Leben schwer machen, wo es über Kopfstein geht, über Wellen, Hektik und so. In Dänemark auch mit dem Wind. Den haben sie ganz fest eingeplant und der ist jetzt mit Covid raus. Seit Mittwoch, glaube ich. Also das ist auf jeden Fall ein kleiner Showstopper für die Mannschaft UAE. Also das war jetzt so der prominenteste Fall.
Ja, wird noch spannend, ob weitere dazukommen. Das kann ja dann durchaus die Tour nochmal ganz anders beeinflussen.
Ja, das war natürlich in den vergangenen Jahren auch so. Aber es ist ja ehrlich gesagt dann doch verhältnismäßig wenig passiert. Aber da gab es natürlich diese strengere, sehr strenge Bubble im Radsport. Das war ja schon so. Und da bin ich mal gespannt, ob wie das dieses Jahr geleveraged wird mit dem, was eigentlich an Abmilderung ist und gleichzeitig der Frage, wie man das dann im Einzelfall unter Kontrolle halten kann, dass man sich nicht infiziert. Also ich habe ein paar Fahrer gesehen, die jetzt sich zum Beispiel darüber Sorgen gemacht haben, dass sie auf dem Weg nach Dänemark mit dem Flieger eben unter Leuten saßen, die keine Maske trugen und sie selber hatten die Maske. Solche Sachen habe ich gesehen. Das kann man ja verstehen. Stell dir vor, du fährst zur Tour de France und das wäre jetzt deine große Sache im Jahr und dann sitzt du in einem nicht für dich nicht kontrollierbaren Umfeld. Da kann man sich schon vorstellen, dass einem das Sorgen bereitet.
Hm, ja, klar. Ja. So, jetzt hast du aber auch was vorbereitet.
Ja, mhm. Natürlich.
Mhm. Mhm. Sag mal, hast wieder ein Interview geführt, ne?
Ich habe mit Daniel Friebe gesprochen.
Der ist einigen bekannt, einigen bestimmt unbekannt. Erzähl mal.
Der ist ein englischer Autor, schreibt über den Radsport, macht aktuelle Geschichten, ist aber auch für ein sehr, sehr epochales, würde ich fast sagen, Buch über Eddie Merckx bekannt. Mhm. Ein sehr gutes Buch hat er geschrieben. Ist gar nicht so lange her. Er ist auch ein Nachgeborener, also er ist ein bisschen älter als ich. Hat also die Merckx-Ära nicht selbst aktiv erlebt, sondern hat das aufgearbeitet, aber auf eine Form, wo man sagen muss, sehr lesenswert, mit neuen Details damals auch. Und jetzt hat er ein Buch über Jan Ullrich veröffentlicht.
Sag mal, was ist denn da bei dir los? Bist du da auf einer Baustelle oder was wird da
geklopft im Hintergrund? Das ist die Papiertonne, es wird Papierfetz. Das ist ja so, dass die Hausverwaltung dazu aufruft, auch im Sinne der Allgemeinheit, die bei Zalando oder Ikea bestellten Kartons zu verkleinern. Das kann man ja auch nachvollziehen, wenn ich jetzt zum Beispiel meinen Fahrradkarton bestelle. Dann, wenn ich den da in Gänze reintue, ist natürlich klar, dann ist ja kein Platz mehr für die Mango-Kartons der Nachbarn. Das war das Geräusch im Hintergrund. So, und der hat jetzt ein Buch über Jan Ullrich veröffentlicht. Das Sujet ist uns bekannt. Wir hatten Sebastian Moll bereits schon hier im Podcast. 25 Jahre Ullrich Sieg bei der Tour de France. Dieses Jahr ist das Jubiläum nicht zu übersehen. Wir folgen ja den Gesetzmäßigkeiten der Kultur. Ist einfach so. 25 Jahre sind bedeutend für uns etwas. Oder nicht, David?
Ja. Nee, ist so gelernt, ne?
Klar. So gelernt und finde auch berechtigt, dass man solche Epochen nutzt, um zurückzuschauen. Mhm. Und das ist also die zweite Biografie, die dieses Jahr erschienen ist. Die gibt es nur auf Englisch und passenderweise auch das Gespräch, was wir geführt haben, nur auf Englisch.
Genau, also wir fangen jetzt nicht noch an, hier irgendwas zu übersetzen. So viel Hörverstehen-Kompetenz kann man unseren HörerInnen
denken.
Hier zutrauen.
Wir sind ja der Podcast für Entscheider und in den meisten, oder innen, EntscheiderInnen, in den meisten Unternehmen, die wir hier bespielen, sei es Pharma, sei es Architektur, sei es sogar teilweise Engineering oder Hightech.
Zum Teil auch Investmentbanking ist auch dabei.
Investmentbanking. Also Englisch ist eigentlich die Lingua Franca dieser
dieses Podcasts.
Ja, eigentlich müssten wir auch dieses Gespräch schon in englischer Sprache.
Yes, we should have talked in English.
Yes.
So, genau. Hatten wir letztens schon festgestellt, dass hier, aber ich glaube noch nicht on the air, sondern off record, dass hier die Entscheiderinnendichte nirgendwo in der ganzen Podcast-Sphäre so hoch sein dürfte wie in diesem Podcast. Zumindest eine Entscheidung haben manche schon getroffen, bei manchen steht sie noch aus und wir halten das für eine sehr kluge, vorausschauende Entscheidung, uns nämlich hier bei Steady auch entsprechend monetär zu unterstützen, um es nochmal gesagt zu haben. Es heißt ja, man solle es erwähnen. Ich weise da also jede Verantwortung von dir und nehme sie auf mich. Ich weise immer wieder darauf hin, dass das hier also zu erfolgen hat. Schluss mit Lutschen. 50 für 50.000, das ist die Kampagne, die läuft steady. 101 Dinge, die ein Rennradfahrer wissen muss. Der Podcast zum kleinen gelben Klassiker, der übrigens auch nach wie vor Gültigkeit hat. Und also die Inhalte sind nach wie vor korrekt, die da drin stehen. Sind noch nicht veraltet, ist eigentlich ein Evergreen, ein Longseller, deswegen auch zurecht und immer noch verfügbar. In ich glaube, 27. Auflage inzwischen.
Hör auf, dritte.
So, Daniel Friebe kommt jetzt, das Interview Friebe. Mit euch beiden. Friebe, genau.
Bring es jetzt, komm, hau raus.
Ich bringe es. So, jetzt kommt Musik und dann geht's los und wir hören ganz gespannt zu.
It's a Monday morning, and well, I'm happy we both made it. It's earlier where my conversation partner is. It's much earlier, an hour earlier than where I am at. Where are you at, and who am I talking to?
So this is Daniel Frieber, deutscher Name. Ja, ich wollte zuerst mich entschuldigen für, dass ich heute auf Englisch sprechen werde, weil das Thema einfach ein bisschen zu sensibel ist. Mein Deutsch ist leider ein bisschen mangelhaft. Also ja, wir werden über Jan Ulrich auf Englisch quatschen. Aber momentan bin ich in London, aber normalerweise ja, wohne ich in Berlin.
Okay, also dann haben wir das geklärt. Friebe or is it Frieb? How do you pronounce
it? It's Friebe. Although I don't really have any German heritage, I have Polish heritage, but my family is from relatively near the German border, hence why I guess I've got a German surname, although no one really in the family knows, and no one in the family pronounces it correctly, except me.
So when I heard, you hear different pronunciations on depending on who's saying your name, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to speak to you about Jan Ulrich, and not only about Jan Ulrich, but about a project that must mean a lot to you. There's a beautiful yellow book that just came out, also in Germany. You can get it. People, I've seen a lot of people read it already. It's the first actual biography of Jan Ulrich, we must say. Tell me a little bit about the scope of the project, how long and how many hours or whatever, what dimension has been for your to work for you.
Well, Tim, as you can probably tell, and as I think you know, it's just been monumental for me. I mean, I started working on this project in 2015. I mean, I often think that instead of releasing the book, I should release the folder that's on my desktop, on my laptop computer, for people to see just the scale of this project. But it started in 2015 with the intention that I would finish within a year or less, even a year or two, because I'd written a few books prior to that in that sort of time scale. And it started along those lines. It looked as though it was going to take about a year. I did a lot of interviews very early, really key interviews as far as I was concerned: Lance Armstrong, Walter Gordofrud, Rudi Pevenage, a lot of these guys who had not really spoken very much publicly about Jan, and I managed to get those early. But I was having some kind of personal problems, and had been for quite a long time with regard to my work and my ability to be productive, and and it was affecting my health quite a lot. So I also became very aware that it was a very, very sensitive subject, as we said initially. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was writing about the life of someone who had had a lot of problems, was still having some problems, although in 2015 they were less well known than they are now. And I had to get it right, and I had to be comprehensive, and it wasn't fair just to be more preoccupied with my deadline than I was with doing the work justice. So I didn't stop the project. I was always determined to carry on and to finish, but I thought that it would take another year. But another year went by, and then I was still working on it, and another year went by, and I was working on these personal issues as well. And then as I was sort of starting to make progress and get close to the end, then Jan had his very well-documented problems in 2018, and that created another roadblock, really, because, well, I had to cover them. I had to figure out how to cover them. I had to try to be, well, I don't think I would have felt comfortable bringing the book out in 2019, for example, because too little was known about his mental equilibrium. And I also needed to finish the story, in the sense I needed to say what had happened in 2018 and since 2018. And that last piece of the jigsaw was a long process, because again, the whole subject and Jan himself are very sensitive, and I think still are to this day.
I've read some criticism, well, that the authors, you're not the only one who's publishing a book right now this year. We've also heard from Sebastian Moll on this podcast, but I've heard the criticism that this is well-timed, and authors are trying to make
the most of the 25-year anniversary of the Tour de France. Now, it seems like in your case, okay, you've hit the right timing, but it's been a long-going project, and I don't know if there was any calculus to at least have it released for that meaningful anniversary.
No, from my point of view, it was helpful for me because the publisher had been incredibly patient with me, and I was mm-hmm. very grateful for that. So it was helpful for me. I knew that finally this year in 2022, I would probably finish. And it was helpful for me to go to the publisher and say, oh, look, you know, it's the 25th anniversary of him winning the tour. So actually, it kind of works. Yeah. But there was absolutely no calculus and, you know, on my part about that. The other thing I was aware of and I have been aware of over the last few months is that this period, these few weeks now, in these few weeks, there would be a lot of discussion about the 25th anniversary and mm. there would be a lot of attention on that. And, you know, in some respects, that kind of reassures me, or it made me feel less nervous about the book coming out because I feel that it's one of many things and it's a mm-hmm. conversation that is being had generally. And I think, well, you know, Tim, and maybe we'll speak about it later, you know, I decided that the book wasn't going to come out in German. That was a conscious decision on my part again,
yes.
Out yes. of sort of concern for, not because I think that it's, I mean, I personally think it's a very fair book and a compassionate book and a sympathetic book, and that was always mm. my intention. But when you put a book out into the world, particularly in a different country from the country where it was intended to come out, you kind of lose control of it. And the publisher in question, you know, wanted to make quite a big deal of it. They wanted to promote the book a lot. And then I would possibly have looked as though I was trying to cash in. And I was, mm-hmm. and I wasn't really concerned about Jan and his health.
Yes.
So yeah, I took that decision, and I'm very glad I took that decision. To be honest, it was quite a difficult decision at the time, but I'm pretty glad I took that decision.
It's good that you raise it. It was on my list of yeah. questions, but that's very remarkable, I would say, because essentially you do work for the money, and you do work for the commercial side of things. I do too. Everyone does, because they want to sell their art or their project or their journalism and yeah. their books, and you decide, and that means that you have a different look at the personality you write about, at the person or the human being that you write about. You need to be careful with what you publish and which language you publish it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sort of labor this point too much, but I think people can probably, I mean, you know what the book industry is like, and you know how much or how little is involved, and people can probably imagine that if this took 7 years and for it was taking months out of every year for 7 years, this was not a lucrative project for me, and the opposite. I mean, it cost me an awful lot, sort of emotionally and financially as well. But that was my decision, and I wanted to do it, and I was determined to do it, and I felt that I'd made that commitment, mm-hmm. and I had to finish it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back to the start of your book, in which you have described something like an, I would say, aesthetic fascination of mm-hmm. for Jan Ullrich. And do you think that this still carries on for you? Do you see this image of the young writer that goes to smash and in style smashes the competitors at the Tour de France with a style that maybe no one else has been able to show? Do you still have this fascination for this moment or for this athlete that became more than just one winner?
I think the first years when you become infatuated with a sport or a type of music, the first sort of flush of infatuation, the first two or three mm-hmm. years, the sort of images are almost on a kind of in a golden kind of bubble, and they have a magic, they have a vibration that's different and it's more intense. And I talk about this in the book, how things at that age seem to contain more and they mean more. And that was certainly the case for me. These were the first, it was really the second Tour de France that I'd paid a lot of attention to. And it was an era as well. There were a couple of things in that era. One was that it was the year before the Festina scandal. So people were still watching the Tour de France, although there had been talk in the media, but I think only if you really followed cycling closely, you knew what EPO was, and you knew what how widespread doping might be. most people were watching the Tour de France with that sort of untainted awe and amazement, and the questions were not in the back of their head when they were watching. They certainly weren't in my head. So there was that, and also it was before obligatory helmets. The riders often were, they weren't even wearing sunglasses. Jan Ulrich that day in Arcalis, he wasn't wearing a cap or sunglasses or a helmet, and you could see, you know, you could see his face, and he had this, you know, beautiful German national champions jersey, clean with no sponsors on it, and it was a beautiful day. And yeah, there was a lot aesthetically about that day which really sort of encapsulated what I was at that particular time finding absolutely mesmerizing about professional cycling. And also, you know, in the UK, and there are definite parallels with Germany, cycling was not a big sport. It wasn't even a medium-sized sport. It was a fringe, a niche interest. And if, when as a teenager, you're discovering something that not that many people are interested in, you feel like you're entering a secret society, and it makes it even more special. And that was the case for me.
Okay. And that is still lingering somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. That also would justify a book that has a very, I would say, one of the best titles I've ever seen. I think the best there never was is something that points at the complex nature of the phenomenon that we have. I would say, as a social scientist, it seems to be dialectic because it has various versions of the truth comprised. I mean, we don't want to usually have artists explain everything, but maybe you can let me know how you intend this title to work, and why do you think he was the best there never was? What's the point here?
Well, first, a slight confession. I kind of plagiarized. I kind of stole the title from a documentary, an ESPN documentary.
I know.
Oh, you do. You know that. I don't know. I don't know how many people know that. So there was a ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about a high school football player called Marcus Dupree, who was a phenom, a prodigy, and things didn't turn out the way that people expected them to turn out. And his career, he did have a career in the NFL, but it was a fairly, I suppose, insignificant career. And it's a kind of a sad story. And to be honest, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the parallels. I loved that documentary. I loved the title. And it seemed to encapsulate a lot of the elements of the Ulrich story. But you are right. You know, you can interpret it in different ways. Am I suggesting the best there never was? Am I suggesting that it was all a mirage, that actually what we were seeing didn't truly exist? You can interpret it in that way. The best there never was also in the sense that that was very much what was being said, that he was going to be the best there had ever been, certainly after that day in Arcalis. And it was really important for me. I was absolutely insistent that the cover image had to be that day in Arcalis because the title almost relates and speaks to that image and all those exaggerated predictions that came after that day. And I include a lot of them in the book, from people saying he would win 10 tours. And it really, I mean, I was naive. I hadn't watched that many Tours de France. It felt like that to me. It felt obvious that it was just impossible to see how anyone could possibly beat the guy for the next 5-10 years. And also, for a non-German audience, we had no sense of any vulnerability, because our image of East German sports in particular, and Germans in general, was of robotic, metronomic, unemotional sort of automatons. And that was what we thought Ulrich was. I don't know in Germany how much sort of intangibly you could feel that this guy might be vulnerable, because he hadn't shown much of that certainly to the wider German public. But certainly it didn't enter my head that this guy was not just going to continue on the same trajectory. I mean, I've answered a bit. I think there are probably other elements that we could draw out of the title, but there's certainly a couple of them.
Yes, but the best, that's something I would say that justifies a book of this scale. But if you look at the palmarès, it might be in doubt, you know. So that's interesting, because he has a certain, I would say, a unique selling proposition in the world of cycling. At least if I look back at the last couple of decades, I would say there was perhaps no other that had this this complexity within his personality and within his palmarès and within what happened outside of his personal problems.
I mean, the other thing, Tim, is that, I mean, this was not the main reason why I decided not to bring the book out in German, but it's very much, it's a book written for non-Germans in the sense that, you know, I talk about, I mean, I went to live in Berlin to write the book, and still I've been living mm-hmm. there the last few years, but it was kind of an outsider's perspective on Germany and the Germans and Jan Ullrich, because you in Germany throughout the course of his career, you had a running commentary, and, you know, German, the standard of German journalism, people might disagree, but compared to the rest of Europe and compared to the rest of the world, is pretty rigorous. And also, German newspapers are pretty widely read compared to in other countries. So you had this kind of running commentary of Ulrich's career. And in other countries and in the English-speaking world, he remained, there was a lot of mystique throughout, because a lot of that stuff wasn't being translated and wasn't known. So that was another reason why I wanted to tell the whole story, because I just felt that there were so many layers to this that were just completely unknown outside of Germany. And some of them, a lot of them in Germany, are kind of unknown. And I wanted to provide as sort of complex and complete and comprehensive a picture as possible.
And I think I sent you congratulations yesterday via WhatsApp, because I had finally had the chance to read most. I haven't quite finished all the pages, but I did then go to the end, and then I chose some parts in between, and so I think I've covered 80% now. And I think it's more than just a biography, it's also a very good portray of what the cycling, let's call it industry, or the professional sport and the whole environ was over those 20 years, this period that has shaped also for my personal perspective as a journalist, who I jumped into cycling coverage in 2005. So I had a pretty quick roller coaster ride from the German media perspective. And then you've got this guy who obviously drew all of us in. So I think it's a very, you have the personality, but of course you also, with the people that you spoke to, you present much more. You have a very, if you want to understand something about cycling over the last two decades, I would say this is recommended or required reading. Would you agree? Was this part of your attention as well, to not just
it was,
show
I mean,
his pers-
yeah, well, it was my era. I mean, I started working as a cycling journalist in 2001, so it's the era that I still almost feel at most at home in. It was an era in which I started, and the sport wasn't Anglophile. It wasn't socio-demographically, it's changed quite a bit. A lot of the riders now are pretty well educated, and they're from middle class families. It was back then, still, they were mostly, you know, from sort of working class stock. Doping was the prevalent conversation. It was a different sport to the sport we have now, and I knew that I had something to offer, having covered the sport in that era. And it offered, in a kind of voyeuristic sense and a guilty sense, it offered great stories. I mean, some of the doping stories are absolutely shocking, but people find them titillating, and people find them absolutely, well, eye-wateringly compelling. So, you know, I wanted to tell a story, and it, look, at every step of the way, it was really important for me to put Ulrich in context. So the context of East Germany, the context of West, United Germany and telecom, the telecom machine, the context of professional cycling in that era, and, you know, even the context today of what people expect of him and how he feels within that kind of vortex of expectation and pressure and misunderstanding. So, you know, every separate issue that I encountered in the book regarding Ulrich, I tried to sort of stop and think, okay, well, what's the other side to this? How does he, how, you know, I don't really offer interpretations, but I try to lay out different sort of dimensions and different aspects of each of those sort of micro stories, just to make people think, really. And because, you know, to psychoanalyze him would be a futile exercise anyway, because none of us, I mean, you could get 10 psychologists here and they would all have different ideas about whether he's been affected by a childhood trauma, a trauma in resulting from the 1998 tour, or trauma resulting from his retirement, and they would not find any kind of consensus. So I, as a cycling journalist, I'm certainly not going to find any answers on that.
Okay. So that would be an obvious question, because looking at the patterns or the things that Jan Ulrich went through, starting with his, it's obviously a difficult childhood with his father leaving, with violence in his family, with alcohol, then going on through a system that was very, I would say, just wasn't focusing on his personal characters, but was focusing on his performance as an athlete as a young kid, then the breakdown of the socialist regime, his prodigy turning him into a hopeful for people that invest millions of D-mark or then euro into, as you said, the telecom machine. So he was seen as a mere vessel of for hopes of other people. So I was going to this to try and get something out of you in terms of, let's put it my way. I would say he never had a chance to mature as an actual character, because he never had that freedom, and he never had the people that actually let him breathe or make free experiences. Would you go so far, or would you not judge that at all?
It's really difficult, because you can't deny there are people who went through that system, and okay, their family circumstances might have been different, but they didn't have the same, they didn't encounter the same problems later on. And this, the access to new freedoms when the war came down after the Wende, and you know, it didn't pose them the same problems as it seems to have posed for him. But then I said psychologists or psychiatrists or psychoanalysts, they wouldn't agree necessarily on the effects, the extent to which he was impacted by, you know, his father leaving or his father being violent or drinking. But I, you know, statistically, that you can't deny there's definitely a link between that kind of childhood and problems later on. So I think we can probably, it's probably safe to assume that that has had some impact. But, you know, in the course of researching the book, you know, I spoke to people in Rostock who would argue that he still had a good childhood, and that he was surrounded by love, and he had a series of, it's kind of interesting, this procession of father figures that he had one after the other. Yeah. Peter Sager, Peter Becker, and then Wolfgang Strohband, and then you could argue Rudi Pevenage later. So, I mean, if we kind of jump ahead almost to the present day, my impression of what has caused him the most problems is his inability or unwillingness or lack of confidence in communication, and the inability to sort of establish a new narrative for his life and for his career. That, you know, we've seen, it's been very obvious, we talked about that era, that kind of dirty era of professional cycling. The guys who have thrived in their lives thereafter are the ones who have been able to establish a new narrative for themselves, both, I think, probably in their internal monologue with themselves and also in the public domain. So guys like, you know, Rolf Aldag or Lance Armstrong or David Miller, you know, all different ways in which they've done it. I think one common theme between those three also is the facility with language as well, and actual communication. And, you know, it's quite striking that, you know, Rolf Aldag in 2007, in the week when probably Jan Ulrich should have confessed, the week when all of the T-Mobile riders confessed, the T-Mobile riders of that era. And that was, I think that was probably the greatest opportunity of all. In that week, you know, two weeks later, Rolf Aldag was back managing T-Mobile. And his life didn't really pause. And he kind of changed course slightly. But, you know, I always think that, you know, we don't like doing things that we're not good at. And I think Ulrich knows that he's not a particularly gifted communicator, and it doesn't come easily to him, and it never has. And I think that's the thing that currently in the present day is, or up until recently, had been causing him certainly a proportion of his problems. But again, you know, that's probably a judgment too far as well. But
okay, yeah, well, it's an attempt, right, to understand.
Yeah.
And I have this, I wrote it down here on my list of questions. Armstrong, obviously, it's one. I don't know how much you want to tell us about it, but I think this is a very powerful part of your book, where you sit down with Lance, or you go hit some balls with Armstrong and then drink beer. And he starts crying when he thinks back of Jan Ulrich communicating, which I think is maybe after what you just said, it's maybe even more powerful, because that would be something that could move people. Maybe you can tell us what happened and why did he cry?
Yeah, well, I guess quite a lot of listeners will have seen another ESPN documentary by Marina Zenovich that came out in 2020 about Armstrong, called Lance, and they will have seen Armstrong reflecting on Ulrich's problems in 2018 and breaking down in tears. Well, I'd had this... This was it. Almost that scene almost stole my thunder, because I'd seen this and I'd witnessed this. And in 2015, when I spent a day with Armstrong, as you say, playing golf in Texas, and you know, the whole prelude to my interview with Armstrong, well, in that he'd made very clear that he was he had great affection for Ulrich. And, you know, he sort of said on email, oh, God, if you're going to say anything bad about Jan, don't even come to Texas. And so that was clear from the outset. And he was very willing to talk about Jan. And it was based on, and, you know, I learned this from Armstrong and I learned this from Johan Brunel as well. It was based on very little during their career. They had minimal exchanges and certainly no social contact. But there was a cynic would say there was an honor among thieves. Certainly, after they'd all been exposed, I think they all felt a kind of solidarity with each other. They all felt they'd been roughly treated in some way. So that, I think, brought them close together. And I think, you know, a few people said in interviews for the book that Armstrong maybe feels a little bit of guilt. Guilt about how ruthless he was during the career and during the rivalry. And the fact that he changed the course of Ulrich's career and his life by emerging in 1999. So anyway, yeah, after our game of golf, and we've been talking about Ulrich sort of on and off all day, we went back to Armstrong's house, and he sort of volunteered his favourite Jan Ulrich story. And it was a story of when Armstrong first retired in 2005, and a sort of spontaneous request from Jan to speak at Armstrong's retirement party. Well, it was the victory party at the end of the Tour de France, but it was effectively a retirement party. So Ulrich sort of showed up at 1 o'clock in the morning at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, and very awkwardly and not very expansively. There was a few words, but Ulrich sort of said, oh, you know, congratulations on a great career, and I tried to beat you but couldn't. And anyway, recounting this 10 years later brought Armstrong to tears. And, you know, he said it was one of the nicest things that anyone has ever done for him. And, you know, I remember these, I think I write in the book, that these 24 seconds when I'm sitting at Armstrong's kitchen table and he's there just sobbing, thinking about this speech that Ulrich gave. And, you know, I thought a lot about that, obviously, over the subsequent days, and I've thought about it since. And it just seemed to me that, you know, Armstrong was not a guy who expected people to be nice to him, or expected people to because of, I think, the way he lived his life at the time, and maybe the way he'd grown up as well, that he just didn't expect that kind of gesture. And it had come from Ulrich, and it wasn't the only gesture of that nature from Ulrich. You know, there was other times where Jan congratulated him after, you know, time trials or whatever, and Brunhilde and Armstrong sort of look at each other and say, you know, why is this guy congratulating us? He's supposed to be our mortal rival. Why is he so nice?
Obviously, I was trying to get to the present with this anecdote, because there's still some sort of, among, I would say, not only among journalists, but among cycling interested people in Germany, and even among people that followed his career, were fascinated by Jan Ullrich. There was always a feeling that he should be able to come to terms with his past by telling his side of the story, and in a different way than he's done. And I know of some journalists, Günther Wallraff, you mentioned in your book, I spoke to him a lot of years ago. He told me the confession, I think he said, was more or less signed. I'm not sure if he said confession. I don't want to be misquoted here, but it was going into that direction. And that's also the problem. So I'm trying to see your version of it here. If he were to just tell the story the way that he perceived it, and like write an autobiography that reflects and puts all the facts on the table, and also puts the good sides and his positive emotions on the table, do you think that would be a possibility for him to overcome what you maybe see as a trauma, or what you see as a difficult situation? Do you think that he is still in a position to tell his story and move on?
I think it's a necessity. I mean, Tim, you can answer this better than me. I mean, I don't really see, in spite of all the affection we see for Jan Ullrich, and we're seeing it this weekend with the ARD documentary that's come out, being Jan Ullrich, and with the podcast series, and, you know, there's a huge amount of affection for him. In spite of that, I don't think Germany is ready and willing to completely embrace him again and just carry on and just sort of pretend none of it ever happened, until he takes that one, to us, apparently simple step of just saying exactly what happened. And you know, it's not enough to say what he said to, you know, Focus, and he said, he sort of hinted at a few other interviews since then, oh, I had contact with Fuentes, or I did what everyone else was doing. People just want to get a sense of transparency. And I think as soon as that happens, the moment that happens, I think everyone can move on. And again, you know, I don't want to make presumptions about that, how that will affect his mental health. But I think you would say the same. I think we would all imagine that would lighten a load and relieve a burden. And it would, you know, it would open up opportunities for him in public life as well, earning opportunities as well. And it would remove this embarrassment that hangs over the whole question and hangs over his career. And I'm really interested to see what effect some of these things that are happening right at the moment on the 25th anniversary of his first tour win. I'm interested to see what effect that all has, because, as I say, my sense is that it's not enough to just wipe the slate clean. He needs to also be a participant in that. That's my sense. I mean, I saw it and I write about it quite a lot in the book. The 2017 tour start in Dusseldorf, again, there it was. Yes. It was just all awkward and weird and unbecoming, I suppose, of what Jan Ullrich had meant for German cycling. I make the comparison with the film Goodbye Lenin, which I can't remember what it was called in German, that film, but.
Yeah, Goodbye Lenin, same.
This attempt to obliterate a memory, obliterate a period in time, and that's what it felt like in 2017 in Dusseldorf.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that if he were to tell a story now and, like, offer all the version or the whole version of what he experienced to be the truth, and so have this thing go out and we're able to communicate, do you think that the public in Germany, now this is a broad statement, do you think that we would be able to say, we don't want a confession, we just want a story, and we don't want to moralize you, we just want to understand you? What do you think? Because from my experience, this person also puts on a showcase, or in a showcase, our moral obligations that we put to people that we celebrate.
So you... You as German.
Yes, yes. Obviously, I'm half Swedish, but that doesn't matter too much. So I grew up here and I consider myself, although not always happy about it, but influenced by this, obviously, by this culture, which has a hard time separating morality and facts. And in the case of Jan Ulrich, I think this is one of the most interesting things, to the fallen angel aspect of expecting a hero to be either completely clean or you just throw him out. And I think that is a very strong part of our German storytelling of cycling and of Jan Ulrich, obviously. So I think this still goes on. What's your perspective? Do you think that it would be possible to receive a more, let's say, neutral perception of such a character?
Hard to say. I mean, I'm sure you can come up with some good examples of people who have rehabilitated themselves in German public life, who have at one time been vilified or demonized, and whether through a very smart and savvy PR campaign, or through their own skill, or through a sudden outbreak of compassion in the German public eye, have been able to rehabilitate themselves. But that said, I don't think, in my experience, Germany's is a country and a population that sometimes struggles with to accept fallibility and vulnerability, and doesn't give people who are vulnerable the same sort of soft landing that they maybe get in other countries. I mean, that's a massive, massive generalization, but you also have to, I mean, what sort of proportion, what percentage, what group of the German population really matters, and does Jan Ulrich need to curry favor with? I mean, he already has. You can see it on social media, and it's almost become a bit of a joke and a bit of a meme, the whole Ulava Sauber and that whole joke and meme. You know, there's already a huge contingent of people who believe that he doesn't need to do anything, really, and who are ready to embrace him. But if you we're talking about extending that to the point where, if a race, for example, the Rund um Köln want to appoint him as an ambassador, then it poses no problem. That's really the point that he needs to get to, I think, isn't it? He's not going to conquer. He's not going to rehabilitate himself with absolutely everyone, but he needs to get to the point where he can sort of be reabsorbed into the German cycling community. And I think that confession, I mean, some would argue that even Armstrong has not fully, I mean, he can't itemize every day of his career and say, this day I did this and this day I took this substance or whatever, but broadly to just display a willingness to be transparent. And I think you feel that from someone. I think people felt it from Armstrong to a large extent. I think that's the point at which you can move on, and that Jan would probably be able to move on and to sort of show that kind of vulnerability and that openness, which, you know, as I said, in the confessions that he's given so far, it's always been, yes, it's sort of one, two sentences, and then it's, but I think that was a terrible time in cycling, and and I don't think I was doing anything unfair, and it's immediately defensive. And there's a big difference between that and just being ready for whatever comes at you. It would be uncomfortable for a while, because I know the rigor of German journalists and the rigor of people in Germany's own sort of moral self-inquiry, and they would probably demand more from him than was demanded of Armstrong or has been demanded of repentant dopers in other countries. So it would be uncomfortable, but I think he has to do it.
Now, in closing, as you said at the beginning, one of the things that motivated you not to have a translation in German, it's sympathy for Jan Ulrich. That's correct, right? So, and if I see the book and I see the epilogue and the way it closes, I think we can tell that you have a very strong sympathy, and it seems like you have some optimism about the main character of your biography that you show at the end of the book. Would you say that you hope to be able to be optimistic about him. It's not just someone who you write about, but it's someone you do care for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I cared before I started writing, and I talked about vulnerability. I think with Jan, I think everyone senses the vulnerability, even if we don't know him well. You know, that has been the underlying narrative of his story for a long time, that we all feel that he's vulnerable, and that explains a lot of the affection there is for him. Am I optimistic? I have to sort of defer to the people around him and what they say, and I think they're optimistic, but they're cautiously optimistic. You know, the exact nature of his problems, the problems that he's had over the last 3 or 4 years, I know something about it, as you do and as people in Germany do, but I don't, they're not problems that I experience myself. I mean, I have other problems, but I don't have those particular problems, and it's difficult for people who don't have that personal experience to know how those mechanisms work and what triggers them, and in his case what triggers them. And you know, we've speculated, or we can speculate, and people do speculate about the influence of traumas, of things that occurred 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, it can take years of hard work to overcome those things. Or it could be something much more simple. And, you know, he's definitely had periods where I think things have been going really well for him over the last 10 years. And that's been catalyzed by, I don't know, for example, you know, when he had his reported burnout, he'd rediscovered cycling again. And that was enough at that particular time to keep him happy and healthy. So, you know, I really, really hope that things go well for him over the next few years. You know, I do feel a massive amount of, not to overestimate the impact a book like mine could have, but I felt really burdened with responsibility throughout this process, particularly over the last few months, knowing that it was going to come out into the world. And I felt that I had to be really, really careful and sensitive. You know, I hope that I've done that. And yeah, I guess I've got my fingers crossed like everyone else.
Thank you very much.
Und das nächste Mal machen wir das Ganze auf Deutsch.
Herzlich willkommen zurück zu diesem kleinen, feinen Nischen-Podcast.
Welcome 101 back.
Dinge, die
Welcome
allen,
back.
Rennradfahrerwissens.
Lass dich nicht durcheinander bringen. Don't let yourself get confused.
Bring through each other. Genau.
Correct.
So, was nehmen wir denn jetzt mit? Ich würde sagen, interessant war, ich weiß nicht, wie du das so siehst, aber interessant war doch, ja, so fast der Appell, dass er sagt,
er ist natürlich sehr vorsichtig, aber der Appell steckt ja schon, also seine Einschätzung, dass Ulrich eigentlich seine Geschichte auf seine Weise erzählen muss, um über seine traumatische Lage oder über das Trauma hinwegzukommen. Das finde ich interessant. Das ist jetzt auch nicht der Erste, der das in der oder einer ähnlichen Form sagt, aber er hat sich ja sehr stark mit ihm und seinem Umfeld beschäftigt über jetzt 7 Jahre. Und da steckt natürlich viel Wahres drin, dass man sagt, wie soll man weiterkommen und auch insbesondere als öffentliche Figur weiterkommen. Jan Ulrich wird ja nie eine nicht öffentliche Figur sein können. Er ist es nun mal geworden und es ist schwierig, ohne den Abschluss zu finden, aus dieser Nummer rauszukommen. Deswegen ist diese Erzählung wichtig, und das Lance Armstrong-Beispiel ist ja ganz kraftvoll. Ich habe mich in den letzten Wochen auch immer wieder, ja, ich muss sagen, ich hatte früher, vielleicht darf man das offen sagen, gewisse Antipathien für Lance Armstrong in seinem Auftreten und in der Art und Weise, wie er sich auch geriert hat gegenüber seinen Kollegen und so. Man muss jetzt aber schon sagen, dass er eine sehr positive Wendung genommen hat und eine Haltung hat, die nach allem, was passiert ist, und sagen muss, muss Respekt haben vor dieser Persönlichkeit, die eine starke Position entwickelt hat und die sich selber auch auseinandergesetzt hat mit dem, was war. Und dieser Mann weint dann also beim Erwähnen von Jan Ulrich im Gespräch mit Daniel Freeve. Und das finde ich schon eine kraftvolle Sache. Also das ist, da ist halt schon mehr als das, was wir dann eben sehen, der Betrug und der Sportbetrug und die ganzen schlimmen Sachen, die wir am liebsten verdrängen würden. Aber das ist eben eine Geschichte, funktioniert so nicht. Die ist vielschichtiger und man muss irgendwie auch ertragen, dass das alles Teil dieser Geschichte ist. Also das Gute, Schlechte und das Dazwischen. Und das müsste Ulrich eigentlich mal auf seine Weise erzählen. Und ich glaube auch, wir würden das gerne lesen oder sehen.
Also im Sinne einer Selbstermächtigung vielleicht eher auch wieder und gar nicht mal so jetzt hier so inquisitorisch mal Farbe bekennen, erzähl doch jetzt endlich mal, wie es wirklich war und um da jemanden dann wirklich an den Pranger zu stellen, aber das ist wahrscheinlich auch das, was es so schwierig macht, ne, weil jetzt die letzten oder vergangenen 25 Jahre waren ja jetzt nicht gerade von, sagen wir mal vorsichtig, besonders differenzierter Auseinandersetzung mit der Person Jan Ulrich geprägt, wie zum Beispiel ja auch ein Tim Farin in der Zeit jüngst argumentiert. Ne?
Ja, da ist natürlich jetzt ein Aspekt, den haben wir jetzt im Gespräch nicht so sehr hervorgehoben, aber den hat Daniel in dem Buch auch ausgeschmückt. Der wohnt ja seit längerem verbringt viel Zeit in Berlin. Und hat sich auch auseinandergesetzt mit dieser Wahrnehmung des Ostens, der Ex-DDR in der gesamtdeutschen Öffentlichkeit. Und ein Thema, was immer wieder vorkommt, ist dieses, es war nicht alles schlecht. Und dann kommt eben die öffentliche Korrektur nach dem Motto, nein, das kann man nicht machen, das ist Ostalgie, das ist Verklärung eines Regimes oder so. Und dem gleichen Muster würde auch Ulrich unterliegen oder könnte dem unterliegen. Er kommt aus dem Osten, er kommt aus einem System, was im Nachhinein als teils betrügerisch wahrgenommen wurde. Mhm. Wenn der jetzt seine positiven Emotionen einfach ganz ungeschmückt oder ungeschminkt darstellen würde, dann besteht in jedem Fall die Gefahr, dass man sagt, du bist ein Revisionist oder du bist ein Ostalgiker oder ein Telekomalgiker oder jemand, der die Aufklärung verpasst hat. Weißt du, was ich meine? Also das ist das ist eine historische Falle, weil natürlich das dazu führt, dass immer stärker sich die Leute, die das Positive eben dann doch erlebt haben, weil das hat er ja erlebt, muss er ja erlebt haben, sonst hat er es ja nicht gemacht. Diese Leute, die werden sich zurückziehen und werden eben sagen, die blöden, wie soll ich sagen, Sieger der Geschichte, was wollen die jetzt von mir und mit denen muss ich gar nicht mehr reden. Also ist man hier in einem Kreislauf, aus dem man so leicht nicht rauskommt. Ne? Also weil alles, was er sagen wird, ist, die Gefahr besteht auf jeden Fall, dass alles, was er sagt, im Nachhinein dann doch wieder korrigiert und mit einem Stern versehen werden muss.
Genau. Und da kann man dann die Zurückhaltung ja auch wirklich verstehen.
Ja.
Deswegen, ne, auch da Vorsicht, ne, mit, also der hat es ja auch gar nicht so als Appell formuliert, ne, aber es schwang so mit, ne, dass das vielleicht eine gute Idee sei, aber das ist dann ja doch nicht so ganz einfach hier, ne.
Jetzt kommen die Kinder.
Ja, Grüße an die Kinder.
Komm jetzt vorbei.
Ja.
Ja. Also wenn jetzt Kinderstimmen im Hintergrund zu hören sind, ist das so. Du wolltest aufzeichnen. Ich habe gesagt, ich stelle dir meine Zeit zur Verfügung, aber bitte nicht beschweren, wenn jetzt wieder... ich kann ja nicht mal Care-Arbeit machen, David. Ich kann nur hier sein.
Ja, mal im Moment sein, ne? Achtsam ist vielleicht ganz gut, ne? Wirst du mal zur Achtsamkeit gezwungen.
Ja.
Ja, okay, alles klar. Also, wir lesen das Buch, ne?
Wir lesen das Buch, wir joinen bei Steady und das Buch ist auf jeden Fall interessant. Ich finde es sehr gut. Wer Englisch lesen kann, der sollte das lesen. Daniel Freeber hat auch eine sehr schöne Sprache, gibt sich sehr viel Mühe in der Erzählung und es ist sehr gut arrangiert, das Buch. Und es erzählt halt mehr als nur eine Geschichte über diesen Mann, sondern es erzählt die Geschichte einer ganzen Epoche im Spitzensport. Das ist ja auch nochmal relevant, dass da eben die Vorgänge dieses Systems aufgearbeitet werden in einer Form, wo man dann, wenn man das auch mitverfolgt hat, schon auch nochmal mit den Ohren schlackern kann, was da alles passiert ist in diesen zwei Jahrzehnten. Das ist schon ein sehr starkes Buch über diese Ära des Spitzensports.
Also, Tim Farin mit einer absoluten Leseempfehlung hier an unsere HörerInnen.
Ja, und Hörer.
Und Hörer auch. Und Hörer sogar auch. Sehr schön.
So, ich greife jetzt zum Hörer und bin weg.
Alles klar, Ro. Ne? Dann mach's gut und ja.
Grüße.
Werd gesund. Ne?
Das geht ja von selbst. Ciao.
Ciao.
Und da sind wir schon im Ziel dieser Episode von 101 Dinge, die ein Rennradfahrer wissen muss. Die Kompaktkurbel unter den Podcasts. Hast du Lust auf mehr Wissen, mehr Anekdoten, mehr Spaß und Inspiration für deine nächste Radtour? Dann kannst du ja mal nach dem Buch schauen. Das gibt es natürlich in gedruckter Form und als E-Book vom Verlag Bruckmann. 101 Dinge, die ein Rennradfahrer wissen muss. Überall, wo es Bücher gibt. Also im Handel und im Internet.
Finisher, bravo!
Wir sagen Kette rechts und bis zur nächsten Ausgabe.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.